Hashtag embrace the grind. We work for the fans. We work for the 71 Division I teams. Hashtag don't quit.
Welcome back to the Inside Lacrosse Weekend Preview Podcast. Quint, that title, sadly, no longer bears the weight that it has for the last 4 months. The college lacrosse season is behind us, and what a year it was, culminating in the Yale Bulldogs emerging victorious 13-11 over Duke on Memorial Day. They claim the 2018 Men's Division I NCAA Championship, and it brought down it's an interesting thing because on the one hand, I thought that the quality of play overall this weekend, the five games, was really high, but there were three really one-sided affairs. So it wasn't a ton of drama, but man, that final game really delivered for what for my money.
Yeah, I agree. And you could really see it coming if you had kind of studied these two teams this year. You know, broad brush, I thought it was a fascinating year. You got a three-loss champion. You know, Duke ends up losing four games. And I think when I reflect on, you know, when we go forward from this year, I think what's important in the future is not to overreact to losses, especially when those losses are in the conference tournament. You know, when I look at Yale, they lose to Nova to start the season. Okay, they're an Ivy League team, late start. They lose to Bucknell, midweek game. The players and coaches told me, you know, our effort just wasn't, we weren't diving for shots. And then they lose to Cornell in the Ivy League tournament. Humility was that lesson. So as long as you're continuing to improve, what I learned this year is that losses are not a bad thing. They're in fact helpful at times. You know, Duke's loss to Notre Dame in the ACCs was helpful. So that's something that I'll take forward. Now, from Yale's journey, I think I take forward, you know, that gradual improvement. What allowed this team to get over the hump? You know, that's the big question mark. They just continued to play well enough to win. And at times they played sensational. They had all their weaknesses were kind of masked, and was no surprise whatsoever. You know, when I posted that poll, I posted a poll before the Final Four. Terry, you saw it. You know, who's most likely to win the championship? Okay, a lot of people were on the Dane train. They like Albany. And then Maryland had a ton of votes. In my eyes, and we talked about this, Maryland was the least likely team of the four to win the national championship, okay? That team was absolutely positively not built to win two games in 3 days. And I turned the clock back to 2016 and 17, where Maryland did have the best team. Both years, they did, and they won one championship. I think that's my takeaway on the Terps. I just had to say that, you know, as we move forward.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've got a couple more thoughts on them. I think, you know, there's so much about this team that is fascinating, and it really comes down to a multi-year perspective. You know, for a good portion of the season, and I think that this remained true through the end of the year, but maybe diminished in importance a little bit. For a good portion of the season, the way in which Connor Kelly reclaimed this legacy of the right-handed kind of dual-threat offensive force was the story of the year. And I have a lot of respect for him. You know, I think because of the cult of personality around him when, you know, those first 3 years in College Park, you can make an argument that he was really underexposed and arguably underutilized, or at least, you know, not utilized to the degree that he showed as a senior he was capable of. Transitioning that into, like, the broader focus, you know, I think back to last year and the way in which they grinded out teams at the face-off X and really neutralized the possession advantage despite being overmatched in, I think, every single tournament game from a face-off perspective, and the way in which they coached themselves through that. And you think about it in the context also of how frequently Maryland teams have struggled with injuries down the stretch, and whether it was fatigue or attrition. You know, I think back to Charlie Raffa struggling to make it off the field, and that's obviously isolated on the faceoff point, but it expands beyond, you know, to the roster beyond as well. I say all that to say that the stage is set. This was going to be a reset year for Maryland. They have so many
yes.
good young offensive pieces. They obviously have to replace a lot of the defensive end, and one of the things I expect that we'll talk about later in this podcast is how difficult it's going to be to do the top 10 rankings heading into next season. But I look at Maryland and say, their strength is going to be in the experience that Bubba Fairman, Bernhardt, and Logan Mouskouskas, bring back Anthony DeMeo, you know, showing himself as a contributor. And then, you know, Steven Schulenberger, who missed the entire year, but was a guy who was angling to be a starter heading into the season. And that's before you even get to the freshmen that might be able to step on campus and contribute right away. So I think that they're going to be stocked at the offensive end of the field, despite losing Connor Kelly. And I think that more than anything else, they've become the most consistent program in college lacrosse. And so, you know, it would be foolish to bet against them making it back to the Final Four. The question is, you know, can they find the secret sauce to overcome what has been a programmatic deficit under John Tillman to win that, you know, whether it be the semifinal game or, to your point, the second game in 3 days?
No, you know, Terry, everything they do is built to win on Saturdays, okay? There's no program that's better at winning on Saturday. You know, but John Tillman's Achilles heel as a coach is a lack of player development early in the year, leading to a roster that is cut to the bone for two games in 3 days, your two most important games in 3 days. I mean, the fact that they lost that 2016 championship is mind-boggling now when you look at the talent on that team. This year's group overachieved dramatically. At the end of the day, when you're looking at this team, this is not a great team. This is a really good team. This ain't a great team. They're shorties, their lack of second midfield, they are one-dimensional players on offense. I mean, you know, Logan, very one-dimensional. Rotance, one-dimensional. Bernhardt, you know, can't really shoot right now like he should. Will Snyder, disappearing act in championship weekend. I mean, I love these guys, but, you know, this team easily, with a different coach and different mindset, would have been a quarterfinal loser.
Well said. I thought you were going to go the other way. I was like, ooh, that is a bold statement. But I actually think that was true for a couple of teams as well. You know, we talked about it last week, and I thought that Denver was a team that exceeded its talent potential. But I want to
Denver,
talk about...
Denver is tricky to me because, remember, we go back to that game we covered at Durham when Denver had the 4-5 goal lead on Duke, and you're saying, wow, this team's legit. And they blow that game and then never really find another gear the rest of the way, you know?
Here's my take on them. Okay, so I think they were similar to Syracuse and Carolina in the sense that they were very inconsistent offensively, but those issues were masked by Trevor Baptiste and their ability to dominate possession. You know, I think the variability in Austin French's performance in his last two games of the season is evidence to the point that I'm trying to make, which is they have high-end talent that can go for 6 or 7 against a quality opponent. But those same guys are not guys that are consistently going to give you 4 every single game. And that's the difference between them and Yale. And I thought that the fact that Reeves went for a goal and 3 assists in the championship game, you know, despite being the focal point of Duke's defensive game plan, spoke to exactly the level of talent he brought. And then when you complement that with a guy like, you know, for me, Jack Tye's performance, 3 goals in the first half and then forcing the defense to adjust to slow him down after being scoreless on Saturday, that was emblematic of the depth that it takes to win. And it's not to say that Jack Tye is deep. He was their leading goal scorer as a midfielder. He's not depth. He is a bona fide starter. But they were able to win on Saturday despite him going scoreless. And then they were able to put tremendous pressure on Duke's defense because he showed up on Monday. And that's the difference, I think, you know, between Denver's offensive personnel. And I think they're, you know, ultimately for me, the takeaway there, and I want to talk about Albany and Duke a little bit more in depth before we move on to Yale. But one more point on Denver, like, I think ultimately my takeaway for them is I underrated their defense and their defensive personnel over the course of the season.
I don't know about that. I mean, on a possession-based model and based on the teams that they played, the Big East was really lousy offensive teams this year. I mean, Georgetown's a champion of that league. I mean, that offense at the end of the year when their key guy got hurt, really? Providence, no offense. Marquette, no offense. That was a bad offensive league. I throw those numbers. I think those numbers are garbage. Stats are for losers.
Okay. All right. Well, let's talk about the Albany Great Danes. What a season. What a special year. What a year that will be, you know, kind of cherished in the memory. And I think this team's legacy ought to be, you know, for a program that had struggled in the quarterfinals, to jump out to an early lead against those Pioneers and then hold on late and get to championship weekend where they ran into a buzzsaw. There's no shame in that. And obviously with all that's come out in the intervening 5 days about the injury that Connor Fields was dealing with, you know, you and I had our suspicions throughout the year. They were just really good.
I'm no
they
doctor,
really
but when I tore my knee, it was very similar to the way he went down. Again, a bitter taste because of a poor finish, but really a sensational season, captivating fans, playing with good style, and really setting the table. You know, this is a program I think that is in a perfect spot, Terry, and a lot of it comes down to recruiting and the finances. You know, when a place like Hofstra costs $54,000 and a place like Siena costs, you know, at least that amount, and Albany fits a niche right now for, you know, middle-income, blue-collar, normal public school kids who can go there and get some athletic money, and next thing you know, they're playing college lacrosse for really cheap. I think they're in a wonderful spot to just become a top 10, top 5 program every single year.
About this senior class and the way in which they were set up to peak this season, you know, Fields got so much attention, but then when you look all around the roster, it was basically at, you know, every position, in every spot, in every position group, you know, there was a leader. And I think, you know, Troy Ray got a lot of shine. Matt Kinnear did a great story calling him the heart and soul heading into that quarterfinal matchup. You know, Kyle McClancy, it was funny, over the course of the last 2 weeks, we did a feature comparing Final Four players to historical antecedents. And I was like, I really want to compare him to Matt Abbott, but is that too bold? And then I texted you. I was like, who does Kyle McClancy remind you of? And you said Matt Abbott. And it was all the validation I needed to move forward with that comparison. You know, I think he obviously scored more than Matt Abbott did in college. But, you know, for me, from the shallowest, most inconsequential details, such as he wears socks that you can't see through his shoes, or under, you know, ankle socks, basically, all the way up to the fact that, you know, he truly does play defense, wings of faceoffs, and offense. I have tremendous respect and really, really enjoyed watching him play.
Yeah, he's a guy. The more film I watched, the more I saw how many clutch goals he scored this year from the invert, that right-handed behind position. It's a guy who was really recruited by RPI in Albany, went to the across-the-street pub and wings. Next thing you know, he put up a 3.96 and never came off the field. There's, you know, Justin Ray, glue guy on attack. McClancy, you mentioned. Josh Egan, the great scholar athlete, as a two-way middy. Stone Sims on defense.
Who I think is tremendously underrated. I think Stone Sims, you know, he just has, I guess my argument would be, he has kind of everything. I wouldn't say that he is great at any particular aspect of being a number one lockdown close defenseman, but he's pretty tall, he's pretty fast, he's pretty aggressive, he can throw good checks, he can get the ball off the ground. I can't speak to the quality of communication and off-ball defense, but, you know, by and large, he didn't back down from any challenges, and I thought that when you looked at what Albany was doing numbers-wise, for me, a lot of that credit went to Stone Sims.
Yeah, A.J. Cluck, their backup pole, and then Troy Ray. What interests me now, going, and Kyle Russo.
Yeah, you mentioned you left out the first-team All-American goalie.
Kyle Russo was fabulous this year and just didn't look like himself all throughout the playoffs. But a great career. Now, going forward, I think scheduling is really important for Albany because their league's getting better. Okay, Vermont's going to get better. UMBC's getting better. I think the league's on an upward move, which will help them. But too often they've played these games, these blowout games, and they don't get any better. And that's why stepping out and playing Syracuse, Cornell, Maryland, and UMass, and then Yale is so important. Okay, those non-league games give this team a better shot at making a run in the tournament.
Moving on to the Blue Devils. Similar to Albany in the sense that they had seniors at pretty much every position and position group.
Well, yeah, the seniors will take you to the championship. If you just follow bet the team with the most MLL draft picks, you got the winner.
There you go. What's going to be your lasting memory of Justin Gutterding?
Oh, just the effort. You know, his attitude, his determination, the versatility in his game and the energy that he played with. His ability to typically deliver a clutch time, you know, do it or die trying attitude. I saw, you know, we caught the lefty playing wall ball on a game day. And then you could see how that effort, he was tested. I mean, he was tested by Coach Forty and I think Ned Crotty became more of an ally. But, you know, that 6-turnover performance he had in one of their losses late in the year didn't sit well, and the kid kept getting better, and he set a tone. So that's going to be an interesting group because Robertson and Manown can't really do it on their own. I like some of their midfielders who are coming back. You know, you lose Connolly. Are there more transfers? You know, the Fuqua. Yeah, when you think about Maryland and how they benefited from some transfers. Duke, you know, you got two starters. So it's impossible right now when Ed Lee of the Baltimore Sun's writing these early projections. I ain't touching any kind of projections until the transfer wire is because there's whispers. We just spoke about Albany. There's all sorts of whispers, okay? I know a good player who's thinking about transferring to Albany. We hear that maybe somebody there is not happy. So this transfer situation is extremely fluid, and do not underestimate it.
Okay, so a couple points. First of all, Coach 40. Is that what they call Matt? I didn't know that.
Yeah, Coach 40.
That's pretty cool. I like that. You got to distinguish. There can't be two Coach Janowskis. That gets too confusing. The rest of the senior class you mentioned, I think...
There's a lot of more seniors than I thought, though.
Pelton and Welch, Fowler, you mentioned the transfers. To me, that's a huge story because grad transfers traditionally do not work out. Or at the very least, do not work out to the.
They've always worked out for Duke, haven't they? I mean, Cerrone was a transfer.
No, they've been kind of hit or miss.
Their top 15 players were transfers.
They've been hit or miss over the last decade. About half, I would say, have turned into starters. The other half have been guys who, you know, got opportunities early, and then saw those opportunities fade away to underclassmen as the season went along. They weren't like kind of fully maximizing those possessions. But yeah, I want to make one final comment about Pelton and Welch. You know, two guys who were highly touted coming out of high school, who kind of arguably, quote unquote, got recruited over with Giles Harris and Van Rapphorst coming in and starting right away, and still embraced the role that they were asked to fulfill. And in my opinion, were such important glue to that defense, providing depth, and also, I mean, not just depth. I mean, they were you know, starting long poles and such, you know, and making plays in championship games in transition, but I thought the idea that they seemingly didn't grouse or didn't create any problems, particularly because to that point, you know, I would assume one of them expected to start down low or close, and then a grad transfer comes in Kevin McDonough and gets to start right away. You know, both those guys were able to find their way onto the field and make significant contributions over the course of the season.
Yeah, I mean, and Duke's defense is a tough read this year. You know, I liked Pelton's game in the quarterfinals against Johns Hopkins. That was the best game of his career. So he played about 50 games. He finally played like a man. He played like an athlete. And then you could see Welch with his ability to score in transition in the tournament. But when you got Duke rotating this year, when you made him think their off-ball defense was poor, and the numbers show that. Their defensive game plan in the championship game was, I don't want to say odd, but they took a chance that Yale's middies couldn't dodge and score unassisted goals, okay? The other thing that was going on is matchups on the close defense. You know, Cade Van Rapphorst is a first-team All-American from Arizona, but he was rarely put on the opponent's best player. In fact, when they played Maryland, he covered Wisnowskis. Okay, so JT Giles Harris covered Reeves. McDonough was left to kind of run the defense. And at times, McDonough was the most reliable of that trio. So it's just fascinating between reality and perception when it comes to defense and matchups.
Looking ahead for Duke, I don't see an ex-attackman if it's not Brad Smith. He's not an ex-attackman skill set-wise.
Who runs the O next year? Terry, who runs the O?
It's their biggest question because when you look at some of the other places on the field, I presume they're going to be very good in the face-off X. They've got some guys that look like they're ready to make the leap at the midfield, particularly Nekhai Montgomery coming off of a really good tournament, and Kevin Quigley, who finished the year with 14 points. Joey Manown found a role as a invert midfielder. I would, again, be a little concerned if there was going to be heavy pressure put on him to start the offense, and I think Sean Lowry showed that he can play a role. So for me, the starting attack is Lowry, Smith, and Robertson. And the question is, how do they fill their roles? And then the first midfield line is Walsh, Montgomery, and Quigley. That's a pretty dynamic top six, rather. But is there a quarterback in there? And if not, can they run a quarterback-less offense a la Duke? That's the big question because, you know, with Pendergrass coming back, and then they're you know, close defensive pieces. I think that they're going to be okay at the back end. And they've got some guys on the roster that I think can fill in nicely. And like I said, some of those issues can be covered up at the faceoff X. They obviously have a question in goal. I think Turner Upgren's going to be the guy that gets the opportunity right away, although freshman Andrew Benafide will probably get a look as well. But they've got some interesting questions that they got to answer coming in.
Yeah, again, a roster that's always fluid because of transfers to the Fuqua. It's Fuqua, correct? Yeah, I get our business schools. You know, I get Mendoza at Notre Dame and Fuqua confused every single week.
Well, you don't get the one at Carolina confused because it requires like 5 years of professional experience. So unless you're Casey Carroll, you can't transfer in with a year of eligibility left, which is a really considerable disadvantage for the Tar Heels relative to some of their competition. Moving on to the Yale Bulldogs. I mean, first, let's talk about the fact that Ben Reeves on Thursday night, coming off a 115-point senior season, was named the best player in college lacrosse. Winning the Twarton, the 2018 Twarton Award, he also takes home the USILA's Enners Award as the best player in college lacrosse. And I made the comment earlier, coming off of, I believe, an 8-point game in the semifinals, where the attack combined for more than 20 points in that 20-goal outburst against Albany. Reeves went for 1-3 in the championship game, and yet I felt like still had a substantial impact on the outcome.
I think he hit two pipes and had that miss at the end of the game. He easily could have had 4 or 5 goals. It wasn't a great shooting day for him. You know, I broke down. He was ultra-consistent this year. I mean, he had 7 points in the Nova loss, the opening game of the year. He had 5 points in the Bucknell loss, and he had 5 goals in the Cornell loss. So it wasn't like he showed up.
He wasn't the reason that they lost.
Never, never. It was a complimentary midfield scoring. When you look at Sessa, went 0-for in those games. Danagelis had one goal. Kotler only had one. And Ty's numbers were okay. 2 against Nova, 1 against Bucknell, 1 against Cornell. But you know, I think Ben, and we'll talk about the Tawarton because I do have some strong thoughts. But Ben was such a pleasure to deal with this year. What a great kid. You know, watch him in practice. He practiced so hard and so fast. I mean, the first thing I go to practice, and I'm like, damn, that tall kid runs really well. And look at his acceleration. And there's he's got a size 9 or 9.5 shoe. Okay, he's got really small feet for a tall guy, and it's just weird looking if you look at him next time. And I don't think it has any factor in it. But it's just odd that a guy 6'3" or maybe 6'4" now, as he was taller than Larry Quinn last night when they stood side by side, you know, has such small feet. And he runs like a guy who's 5'10".
I know you don't care about this, but we were talking about it in the office this week, and I'm curious as to what your guess is. How fast do you think he would run the 40 or does run the 40?
I don't know, but his 20-yard speed for a guy that size is sensational.
I would guess a 4.5. I think he's like, I think he is a 8.5.
Now, I don't know if he can
like,
open up, but he's got really good choppy acceleration for a tall guy. Yeah. And that's straight line speed. You know, would Alessi catch him in a 40? You know, I was told that Robert Mooney, 28, is their fastest guy on the team goal to goal. 6'4", you know, like an 80-yarder. If he went goal and goal and back. I was told that Mooney, you know, out of Princeton, New Jersey, was the fastest guy. And you can see that. Not as fast in tight spaces. The quicker guys that I thought, you know, Sess is pretty quick. Chris Keating, 11. I thought he had a great championship game.
He's so strong.
He you know, there are times where I didn't really notice him. In that finals, when I'm watching the replay, I'm like, darn, did 11 get every defensive ground ball?
He was good. He was the ground balls on the crease, including the game-winning play or game-sealing play.
Yeah, and you look at his performance in the big games. You know, 7 grounders in the Albany win in New Haven earlier in this year. Former high school wrestler with great stick. You know, just a strong-bodied kid who played really well. And then there's Tyler Warner. I thought he looked a little worn out at times, but man, that kid delivered. Man, he played great. And what a super super awesome kid. All these Yale kids. During the time we spent with them, I couldn't be more impressed. Every single one of them, they're smart, they're mature, they were team guys. It was so refreshing, whether it was Jackson Morrill, Reeves, Warner we met, you know, Chris Fake, you know, kids a superstar of the future. I couldn't be more impressed with them as young people.
couple more seniors that deserve mention. Connor Mackey, the faceoff specialist who gutted through some tendon and ligament issues in his wrist, you know, continued to play really, really tough and battled to a 50% day against Duke, which actually was a little bit surprising. I thought, you know, he had a little bit more of an advantage. Particularly, I thought Duke's advantage was going to be in their ability to change the matchup if they needed to. But, you know, credit to Brian Smith for the way that he just, oh, man, he was awesome down the stretch.
He was. You know, he got the ball out quick. So the wing play, I thought, you know, Mackey's used to dominating the clamp and the ball control of the scrum. So I think it was a little unusual for him when he found himself not winning his move to try to become a tie-up guy. You know, like, if you can give me 3 seconds, 2 seconds, it's a big difference, because then it becomes that three-on-three battle. But Mackey, that kid, hard nose, man. He's gonna be a banker in New York City. I'm not sure how he'll do with that, considering that he is such a intense and physical, bright kid, kind of stubborn and hard-headed. But, man, he was just a force this year.
One of the guys who I have a strong admiration for is Jerry O'Connor, close defenseman, who I think you know, provided so much glue. You mentioned Chris Keating, who came back from injury and looked – he was kind of the secret weapon heading into the season, because it was unclear. You know, he had been a number one defenseman, and it wasn't clear what level he was going to rise to. You know, between that and then Aiden Hines missing – the sophomore missing some time at the beginning of the season, and Fake emerging as a freshman – you know, there was so much kind of fluidity to this defensive lineup, and I thought O'Connor kind of helped to smooth that out. I thought that was really, really valuable. Like I said, just a great senior class, and to your point, you look no further than the MLL draft and identify who has the senior talent. Certainly, we've mentioned Tyler Warner and Jason Alessi, but don't want to not include them in this portion of the conversation. A really, really special group, and one that will be remembered a long time in New Haven.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, Tara, because I like to go back and look at my early season polls, and you guys hit the nail on the head with the early season rankings. You know, having this group as a top four group, which I did, and IL did, and the magazine did. You know, I think I had him at 3 or 4. Okay, what did we miss? Well, we didn't miss much. Okay, I don't think anyone knew that Chris Fake, who was an Under Armour All-American, would become the defender that he would. Okay, we knew Keating was coming back. We didn't know the extent of Hines' health, but so that's a plus. And it turns out that they win with Jack Starr, a freshman goalie, who at the end of the day is less than a 50%, I think, save percentage on the year. But he played terrific down the stretch in the playoffs. And in games they won this year, he was above 50%. I think that's a data point maybe that some of your analysts need to look at. Like, how was the national championship won with a goalie who was less than 50%? What else didn't we know? I just think the gradual improvement from a bunch of sophomores, whether it's Gaudette, Morrill, Kotler, they all took positive steps. I mean, you look at everybody on this team. Dana Jealous is a junior. They all got a little better. And then Tevlin's contributions, 12, a pretty high recruit, was used more as a defensive player, struggling to shoot, but he made a lot of offensive shifts against Duke because of his ability to run and dodge with the ball. So that was a smart coaching move. But so everybody, I think what Coach Shea and his group deserves a lot of credit for is, like, everybody took at least a half step forward, if not one or two steps forward. And that's how you win championships, right? I mean, no injuries, no catastrophic injuries. Everybody got better. They found a couple freshmen to play, and next thing you know, you go from a first-round loser to a national champ.
All right, Quint, let's go ahead and talk to some Yale Bulldogs before we do.
We got Tuarton on the other side of this?
We do.
Great, because I have some strong thoughts from the banquet last night. I'm going to tease my strong thoughts.
I don't think any of the Yale alums are going to be worried about finding gigs. I think that's kind of the idea of attending a school like that. But for those that are, ZipRecruiter has made it easy to hire, has made it easy to find qualified candidates. ZipRecruiter.com/lacrosse is your pathway to doing it. ZipRecruiter sends you over 100 of the web's leading job boards. They don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, they scan through thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invite them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. It's so effective that 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. So if you were looking for a candidate on Tuesday, the day after Memorial Day, and all these Yale Bulldogs are hitting the job market after they just finished their college lacrosse career, you posted your job on ZipRecruiter, and one of them is a great match, you would have had that candidate by Wednesday. With results like that, it's no wonder that ZipRecruiter is the highest-rated hiring site in America. Right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/lacrosse. That's ZipRecruiter.com/lacrosse. ZipRecruiter, the hardest. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. It is, in fact, not the hardest way to hire. All right, Quint, let's go ahead and bring on our guests. And the Inside Lacrosse podcast continues with Yale assistant coaches Andrew Baxter and Andrew Stimmel, both of whom I hope and imagine at this point have allowed the national championship winning moment to sink in. Coach Baxter, is that the case? Has the realization that you and your team has won a national championship sunken in yet?
It's definitely getting there, Terry. Thanks again for having us on, too. This is great. Yeah, we spent a little bit of a whirlwind because we just got back. The whole staff was down in D.C. for the Tourathon for Ben getting awarded there, so that was cool. So we basically had a day to relax, and then we got right back on the road again going down there. So it's been a little bit of a whirlwind, but it's definitely starting to set in. It feels pretty cool, to be honest with you.
Coach Stimmel, how would you describe the feeling?
You know, it's still pretty surreal. I definitely can vibe with Coach Bax on that, and it's starting to sink in a little bit. I just think seeing everybody again, you know, kind of getting to watch the game, put it into context, and then obviously last night seeing Ben win the Tourathon, you know, with all of us together, our staff and our, you know, support staff, and then some of the guys, it's kind of, you know, that the cherry on top of a great week. So it certainly started to sink in, and it's just still pretty surreal, like I said, but just it's an awesome feeling.
So, Bax, one of the reasons I wanted to have this conversation is because you and I had a laugh about the way in which our on-field interview ended. But one of the things about it is that it's really, in my opinion, appropriate and emblematic of what you guys do. I mean, you've got multiple T-shirts that have multiple sayings on the back, and that was, we just basically ended by like repeating them to each other. But like the thing about it is that you guys have worked so hard to establish this culture and this mindset, and you've used a lot of different tools to reinforce it. And the goal was a national championship, but I know that, you know, you as a staff, it was never focused, right? It wasn't a goal-oriented focus. It was a process-oriented focus. So can you speak to the way in which the interplay between developing a mindset and being focused on the process, and then, like, you know, address some of these terms, some of these sayings, what they mean and how they're supposed to work?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's ever since I got to Yale with Coach Shea, and we've always been about the process, and I think what that means is that we try not to talk about our goals as much as kind of what we need to do to get better the next day of practice, and constantly trying to improve the guys. Like, you know, we had another saying, Terry, mid-year was, you know, getting better is a never-ending battle, and we kind of would use that in practice and in film, where it's like, all right, well, guys, the never-ending battle is continuing, and it was kind of like, it was always about, you know, making the invert defense better or making our extra man better versus kind of talking about or thinking about winning the championship, if you will. So it was just kind of cool to actually see all that come to fruition, you know, in terms of the process does work. And obviously it's great to have goals, but you don't need to talk about them or think about them all that much if you're just literally worried about trying to get better at your craft. And I think we do a great job as a staff of doing that as well. Like we hold each other accountable to different things, and we try to make each other better with the way that we, you know, in our meetings and our practices and that kind of thing. So that's kind of been the mindset, like I said, since I got to Yale, and it's been awesome to see that come to fruition. And, I think the guys, I think, just, you know, the other thing I would say is that our energy at practices, I know you've been out there at practices, is contagious. And I think some of the sayings that we have on our shirts and that kind of thing come from the energy that we get from the guys at practice. Like, the guys feed off us and we feed off of them, and we kind of just, you know, some of those sayings, root if we didn't, and that's us, and those kind of things, like, just stem from some of that positive energy that we get from being with each other and working on getting better.
And is it fair to say some of them don't actually really even mean anything? Like, I asked you what root if we didn't means, and you couldn't really tell me.
I think it's more of a, we use it in many, many facets. So, you know, it's like kind of like, I think that, yeah. So it's kind of like, it was like, I think it was on the guys' lifting shirts this year. So it's kind of like, root if we didn't, you know, hit the weights as hard as we could in order to get better, you know. It would be root if we didn't, you know, practice in the rain you could use it with anything, really. And so that kind of became something that we kind of used.
So it's not a function of it doesn't mean anything. It's a function of it can mean anything, or it does mean everything.
Correct. Exactly.
Very good.
Yep.
Kind of adjacent to that, Coach Stimmel, one of the things that a lot of guys spoke about after the win, reset mentality and constantly being challenged. Can you speak to those two points?
Yeah, I mean, I think for us, you know, I think speaking from it, you know, from an offensive perspective, you know, as far as constantly, I think challenging is just, you know, really our culture in a sense of how accountable the guys are to each other. You know, those guys on a daily basis, you know, I can think of Joey Sessa, you know, really every day speaking to our offensive group and talking about extreme ownership and extreme positivity. And just understanding that, hey, you own everything that you do, and we're going to hold you accountable to it, but we're going to be extremely positive about what that looks like. And then I know Coach Bax just mentioned it, but just, you know, that, I think, mentality, I think, within our office of us kind of constantly trying to find ways to make ourselves and our team better and challenging each other. And, you know, I think offering up ideas and you know, things, whether it's defensively, offensively, you know, from a scheme perspective and trying to figure out what the best thing to do is, you know, and really our entire staff, you know, being open and willing, I think, to debate that, to try to find a way to get better. And so I think, you know, that's just part of who we are. You know, and I think it even goes within, you know, the units. You know, something we do, you know, fairly consistently is we do, you know, what we would call 5 possessions or 8 possessions. You know, and it's just a 6-on-6 half field game, and our offense and defense go at each other. And, you know, I can speak offensively that, you know, our defense being as good as they are and playing as hard as they do in practice constantly made us better and constantly challenged us. And, you know, so to me, that's a big piece of, I think, why we improved and why we were able to do some of the things that we were able to do this year. You know, and then I think, you know, really at the end of the day too, I think a lot of that mentality is built from the bottom up, you know, from guys that aren't necessarily playing on the field. You know, there's a culture of accountability, I think, from guys that are, I think, very well respected for their work ethic, you know, that maybe not have a chance to get on the field, you know, that year or maybe in the next couple games. You know, they're holding, you know, someone like, you know, Ben Reeves or Jackson Morrill to the same standard as Jackson Morrill, Ben Reeves are holding them. And I think that's something that's, you know, you don't see every day, but I think that's extremely special and is a big piece, I think, of our success.
So diving into a little bit more of the kind of granular detail of the season, you know, Bax, one of the games that people kind of go back to is that Cornell Ivy League championship in which you guys had come off of a, you know, at least from my perspective, 3-game stretch that was as impressive and as, I use the term, physically dominant as I had seen in years. And then your players spoke about how in that Ivy League championship game, the effort wasn't there. And I'm curious, what role did that play in both, I guess, like, what were the negative and positive aspects coming away from that, given that you hadn't won an Ivy League championship and that's disappointing, but ultimately it was a prompt to refocus heading into the last four games of the season?
So I think, you know, you were talking about the reset, and I think we used that game certainly as a hard reset for us to be like, hey, guys, like, it's not going to be that easy, you know. And I think, you know, not to take any away from those games before the Ivy League championship where we played really hard, it was just like, I think we had, some of the guys might have thought or the team might have thought that it was going to be easier than it really was, you know, and I think it was a combination of maybe a little bit of that, a little bit of fatigue, a little bit of, you know, a couple factors, but I think that game was definitely huge for us. We asked the seniors the other day, actually, like, if we win that game, do we win a national championship? And it was a pretty resounding no. So, you know, I think everything happens for a reason, and that game in particular kind of gave us a hard reset to look back and be like, all right, well, we can't just show up and expect to win every game. We have to adhere to the details. We got to keep getting better, you know. I think and not only on the field, but I think in terms of our hydration and recovery and stuff, we talked a lot about that this year, and so I definitely think it helped us in the long run, that's for sure.
Sim, you know, it's a trope or a cliche in lacrosse that the quarterfinal game is the hardest to win and it's the most important to win. You can really transform your program by making it to the Final Four. So reflecting on that Loyola matchup in just one of the harshest conditions of games that, you know, I saw this year in terms of the amount of rain that fell during the game, you know, when you go back to it, what stands out in your memory?
I mean, I know you touched on the weather. One of the things that probably was hilarious to me that I'll never forget is Coach Bax making fun of mine and Coach Shea's attire for that game, because we were just absolutely getting soaked the entire time in our khakis, in our rain slicks, and then Coach Bax coming out in a towel wrapped around his neck for halftime. So I kind of felt like at that point we had a really good chance to win. but no, in all seriousness, though, it was just, you know, obviously conditions were crazy. You know, it was kind of once we went in at halftime and we came out and saw the conditions, I think, you know, we knew it was going to be a little bit more of a defensive second half. But just the guys, I mean, our ability just, I think, to grind in those moments and know that it was going to be hard, and I think embrace that adversity, you know, from an offensive perspective, we know it was going to be very difficult to score in those conditions. And our guys just kind of, you know, kept coming back and knew we just need to get a couple. You know, just seeing our defense and our ride in that game was incredible, because I just think that kind of epitomizes us, our effort in the middle of the field and our effort and, you know, some of those big plays in the middle of the field with guys, you know, whether it was creating turnovers or just hustling to get back in the hole, you know, getting big ground balls in the middle of the field. You know, those are the things that I think, you know, I'll remember from that game, you know, that really, I think, allowed us to come out on top, you know, and obviously win a big quarterfinal game.
And Bax, you know, kind of moving a game ahead, the Albany quarter or semifinal was a rematch of one of the most highly anticipated regular season meetings of this season. And, you know, obviously you guys were able to jump out to a fast lead, but certainly their offensive prowess kept them as a threat. So how did the semifinals unfold, and what was the immediate aftermath of that like in terms of the speed with which you had to turn your attention to the winner of Maryland versus Duke?
Yeah, I mean, we knew going into that second game that it was going to be a challenge, and it's kind of how we presented it to the guys. It was like, you know, this is going to be a really hard game. And because we knew they were going to be coming for us after the regular season game, and they'd been playing well ever since then. So we really just presented to the guys like, hey, this is going to be really hard and a really big challenge. And, you know, I think it was just incredible the way we came out in that game and really took it personal that, hey, like, you know, Albany's a great team, but we're a great team. And we wanted everyone to know that, you know. I think the guys were, you know, they knew that Albany had a lot of hype going into the game, and everyone was, you know, they had a larger crowd at the game, and felt like everyone was there to see them, and I think we came out with something to prove, and we definitely did it. So that was pretty cool. And I knew during that game that you know, the weekend was going to be special, just the way that we responded to that game. So
interesting. Special. I mean, that's a meaningful word, in my opinion, just in the sense that, is it fair to say, because I've been in this situation as a part of a team where it felt like once you won a particular game, it was like sledding downhill. You know, this snowball effect of confidence. Stan, is that what it felt like in that 36-hour interval between the semifinal and the final?
Yeah, and I mean, you know, back to now, we kind of talked about this. We kind of just felt like, I think, after we won that Loyola game, there was just kind of this, like, pressure that released a little bit. And it wasn't like we discussed it, you know, with our guys or anything like that. But I just think we, you know, like Coach Beck said, I mean, we knew going into the Albany game it was going to be a challenge. But I just kind of felt like our guys loosened up a little bit and, you know, just embraced kind of this opportunity to play in the Final Four. Like, hey, we're here now, and let's make the most of this. And, you know, it's time to just cut it loose and you know, kind of let the chips fall where they may. And I think, you know, after we won that game, going into Duke, we knew, again, it was going to be another huge challenge. But, you know, it's such a short amount of time to prep. It's like, you know, you don't really have a ton of time to overthink it, you know, and weigh your guys down mentally. And so I think they just felt, and I think we felt as a staff, that, you know, we certainly had a great chance, but it was also a big challenge. But, again, I think it was just another challenge our guys were excited to embrace, you know, and kind of go out there and just see what happens.
Following up on that, so Ben Reeves has, you know, finishes off a tremendous 100-plus point campaign with a goal and three assists in the championship game. And then, as you both mentioned, on Thursday, he's awarded the Tort. And Stim, being, you know, the coach at his end of the field, can you speak to what it's been like working with him?
Yeah, I mean, I'll certainly try to. I mean, it's just been one of those things where, you know, trying to put it in perspective, you know, about being able to coach a kid of that ability for the last few years is, you know, has been incredible. And I think he's grown a lot as a player and a person. You know, and I think he's just someone that's, you know, he sets the tone for us in so many ways offensively. You know, his ability to, I think, to lead this year has been a huge difference and has been incredible. You know, obviously him being our captain, but I just think he's grown a lot in that area, and he's really challenged himself and his teammates, I think, to grow. You know, when you have somebody like Ben's ability, I think there's an aspect that you can fall into. I think our guys, you know, at times can fall into it too, where it's just, you know, when things get hard, you can get Ben the ball and he'll take care of it. And he certainly has that ability, but his ability, I think, to know his spots and know when to kind of take over games and when kind of he needs the ball, but to also keep the continuity of our offense going, to involve other guys and to empower other guys is, you know, really made the huge difference. And to me, that's who he is. You know, he had the 115 points or whatever it was this year, and, you know, he went to Torton, but, you know, deep down, Ben, you know, the only thing I think he cared about this year was winning the national championship, you know, and I think you kind of saw that in his response to winning the Torton. You know, he's obviously very fortunate, but, you know, he's just a guy that doesn't want to take anything away from the team or anything away from the group. You know, so to be able to coach somebody like that who's, you know, who knows if we'll ever coach another one like that again, I mean, it's something that's pretty special.
And we'll finish with one more, and Coach Baxter, I'll give this one to you. Obviously, there's, you know, we started by talking about how 4 or 5 days later, it still hasn't fully seeped in, the impact, the meaning, etc. That said, a national championship now becomes the foundation for 2019 and beyond. So as you and your staff continue to fill out the vision for the future, you know, what comes to mind? What are the types of challenges? What are the types of opportunities? What are the types of gifts and assets that this platform provides?
Yeah, never-ending battle, man. It's going to be tough, I think. Obviously, we return a lot of very good players next year that we're excited about. And I think we've been able to do that through, you know, recruiting the right type of kid for Yale. I think it's just going to be, we're going to have to keep that, like the challenge we set forth with these guys, you know, in the playoff time, the same thing's going to be next year. You know, it's been a couple years where we felt like we've had a target on our back every game. It's like, we feel like is the other team's Super Bowl, you know. And it's just going to be like that, I think, from here on out. And so we're just going to have to find, you know, ways to embrace that and kind of learn from it. And I think, you know, as evident of this year, the guys are up to that challenge. I have full faith in all the guys returning that they're going to be hungrier than ever to get back to championship weekend and make another run at this thing. So I think if we adhere to our details and kind of stick to the process, all those cliche things that I think we use in our program that really help us, I think we'll be okay.
Very good. Well, once again, congratulations on the championship victory. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. Continued enjoyment in the celebration, and look forward to seeing you on the recruiting trail this summer.
Awesome.
Thanks, Terry.
Thanks, Terry, so much.
Sideline Swap is where lacrosse players buy and sell their gear, shop heads, helmets, shafts, and gloves up to 70% off, or snag hard-to-find college gear. Tis the season. I've seen a lot of good-looking college gear on Sideline Swap recently. If you're looking for Michigan, if you're looking for Notre Dame, if you're looking for North Carolina, if you're looking for Johns Hopkins, Sideline Swap is the way to go. All purchases are backed by Sideline Swap's buyer guarantee. Head to sidelineswap.com. That's SIDELINESWAP.com, or download the iPhone app today. You think you can find a Twerton trophy on Sideline Swap the way you've been able to find a couple of Heisman trophies on eBay?
I don't know, but that... that gift they gave the Wells Crowthers family was pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. What were your other takeaways from the event Thursday night?
Okay, so I watched online at home, and the delay when you say you're on at 7:30 and you don't come on till after 8, that's frustrating, especially when you're in charge of a young eight-year-old. I just think everybody who spoke, and I love everybody who spoke, needed to trim it back 20 to 30%, okay? You know, my goal when I speak in front of a group is to have the fastest speech, but to have the most impact, okay? If everyone had trimmed it back 20 to 30%, we could have heard more from Ben, because Ben was the briefest, and I wanted to hear more from him. So that's my that's my big takeaway. We didn't really get any analytics. We got no fun stories from Ben about what the journey's been like. It was just a bunch of thanks, and I would like to heard from him what it was like choosing Yale, what it was like building this team, what it was like finally getting over the hump, and maybe some stories about a teammate or two and a coach. I did love the fact that Wells Crowther was a stick doctor and that preferred leather. I thought that was fascinating and really interesting stuff. You know, I love Larry Quinn, and to hear him give credit to Jerry Pfeiffer was kind of made my night. It's a guy that also was influential in teaching me so much. So those were the things that stood out. But overall, I mean, I honestly was falling asleep on the floor watching it on my laptop.
It's tough to compete with Game 1 of the NBA Finals.
Well, that starts past my bedtime, so I wasn't going there. If everyone just cuts it back 20%, they save a half hour.
Yeah, my only thoughts are about the winners and the choices. I have a couple of larger thoughts about the structure of the event.
If Reeves didn't win it, Terry, I would have gone ballistic. I mean, I don't know what I would have done. I would have never mentioned the T word again.
No, I agree. I actually tweeted before the show that if
I saw that,
if I didn't know that there could be a tie. So when Miles and Lyle both won in 2014, it was a huge surprise to me. But that would have been less surprising than anybody else winning other than Ben.
I got a good question for you, though.
Yeah.
Who do you think came in second place?
Yeah, that was the point I was going to make. I wish they released the voting. Or if not, like, who voted for whom rather than what the final order of finishing was. If I were going to guess...
You think Baptiste came in second?
I do, because I just don't think that any of the other three... Probably, actually, you know what? No, I think Gutterding came in second, Baptiste came in third, Spencer came in fourth, and Kelly came in fifth. That's my bet.
Okay.
On the other hand, I could have believed, you could have talked me into, at the very least, Kali Ullmiller and Sam Apuzzo winning. And then, because of the legacy or tradition of national championship bump, Kristen Gaudian winning as well, And then even then, like, the award has kind of leaned so heavily toward Maryland that, like, I'm sure Megan Whittle's vote total probably exceeded people's expectations. So I would actually say that, you know, for the women's award has been hotly contested or hotly disputed each of the last 2 years, which obviously implies that there were, and I'm not including 2018, but in 16 and 17, there was not a consensus runaway candidate. I think this year, Sam Puzo, in most people's estimation, deserved to win. But, you know, there was a lot more drama, as far as I was concerned, on that side, on that side as well.
Line of the night, Joe Beninati. I need a wedge.
It really is. It's getting worse and worse as these women that dominate college lacrosse get taller and taller, too.
So they're 5'9", 5'10", 5'11". Joe is not my height. Okay, and so they're adding 3 or 4 inches of wedge, and they walk by him. They can hardly give him a high five.
He can hardly give them a high five.
That's great.
All right, Quint, we've got one more thing that we want to discuss. This is actually we're going to come back one more time before the summer kicks into full gear and talk about some of our favorite moments or events of the college lacrosse season. But as a way to wrap up the 2018 campaign, we are going to go over our top 20 win totals, reflect on the ones that we got right, the ones that we got wrong, whether we were too high or too low. You want to start at the back end, and we'll run quickly through those and then finish at the top? All right.
Go ahead.
So for whatever reason, we included number 21, which was Villanova. This win total only included the regular season and conference tournament. It did not include the NCAA tournament.
Lost that game.
That was the instruction. True, but there are other teams who did win, and I just want to point out that we were instructed at the beginning of the season to pick on the basis of regular season and conference tournament results. Villanova, you and I both predicted that they would win 8 games. They won 10. Congratulations to the Wildcats for exceeding our expectations. Number 20, Richmond Spiders. I predicted they would have won 11. You predicted they would win 8. They indeed won 11.
Nice job, Terry. And that's a team with some really good athletes, young players. What is it, Sabaco?
Yep.
Really caught my eye. The wing shooter they got there on offense. They got some good young players. Yeah. They're doing a fine job. Yep. Dangerous team, Hatfield, going forward.
Boston University. I predicted 9 wins. You predicted 11. They came in at 8. But, you know, man, this is the thing. They're good in February and March. They need to figure out a way to be better in April. And that, you know, Patriot League tournament loss is one that's going to stick with the program. They had a good quarterfinal win. That goes a long way.
Yeah.
Number 18, the Brown Bears. We predicted 9 and 9.5, respectively. They finished with 6 wins and will include number 17, the Army Black Knights. I predicted 8, you predicted 10. They clocked in at 5 after getting off to a hot start this season.
Yeah, something happened there. Have your investigators go up to West Point and figure out what was going on there. And the other thing about Brown is, you know, defense holds separately. And when you saw them in person, I mean, you compare them to the physicality and size of Yale, it's like two different leagues.
Which is crazy, because even though they weren't as big or strong or physical in 2016 as Yale was this year, they were so much bigger, stronger, and more physical in 2016 than they are this year, they being the Brown Bears. And got to figure out a way to get back to that.
Love their goalie, though. Love their goalie. I think he's a really talented kid. I would draft him in the first 2 rounds of Major League Lacrosse when he's a senior.
Number 16, Virginia Cavaliers. I had them at 9. You had them at 10. They finished with 12. One of the teams that we were most
They actually
under
won a game
on.
In the ACC this year and then made it to the NCAA tournament.
It'll be very fascinating. I think that they're going to be the team that is the highest riser between where they finished in 2018 and where they are ranked preseason 2019.
Why?
And because they play a brand of lacrosse that a lot of analysts like. I know your boy Anish is very high on them. I know
Anish and Lars get along really well. Okay, and I see marginal improvement from this group next year. Absolutely, totally agree with that. You get Ryan Conrad back healthy. You've got Dox Aiken, Moore, and Kraus to build around. You know, this Canadian big kid that they're bringing in is a player. So I think the offense will be better. D mids are still going to be a little bit not the depth you need, and then. Just the lack of defense and goaltending is alarming, that I think that prevents them from making a run to championship weekend. You know, to me, they look like a quarterfinalist next year. My preseason poll, I'm guessing right now, I'd say Virginia will be a 7, 8, or 9.
I agree with that analysis almost exactly. You want to hear a pretty crazy stat? So this is their adjusted efficiency numbers. They finished 17th overall, right? You would kind of expect, I think, that that would be heavily weighted toward the offense. Maybe they finished like right around top 10 in offense, right around 30th in defense. No, they finished 23rd in offense and 22nd in defense. Is that not surprising that their defense actually rated better than their offense?
Yeah, they had to, they had moments late in the year where they actually looked like a decent defense. That's interesting.
And number 15, the Marquette Golden Eagles. I had them at 8. You had them at 7.5. They finished with 6. We were both over. Towson Tigers. I had them at 9. You had them at 8. They finished with 6 wins as well.
I knew Towson was not going to be the year for them. They had just lost too much.
Penn State, ranked number 13 in the preseason. I had them at 13 wins. You had them at 11.5. They finished with 8 wins. And boy, oh boy, that end-of-season result against Michigan is going to be one that sticks with the team.
They're a team I actually like a lot going forward.
I agree. Let me ask you this question. Probably the – was Grant Ament the most impactful player who was lost for the season?
You could argue, yeah. And about two-thirds of the way through the year, Terry, they were playing great offense without him.
It's compounded by the fact that he was lost so shortly before the season. You know, it's not one of these guys that was lost in the fall, and you had the entire spring to prepare for his absence. And then also, my sense is, and I'm not, you know, I haven't gotten a ton of clarity on this. I've heard conflicting things. My sense was that there was a belief throughout the season that he was eventually going to come back. So I think that there might have been a correlation between some of those late season struggles and the finality that he wasn't going to come back this year. We've seen that happen in the past. And I wonder how much that might have impacted the way that the end of their campaign unfolded.
Well, I'm going to give Penn State one more chance next year because I think they could be second best, maybe even better, definitely top three in the Big Ten next year with what they bring back. Okay, when Jeff Tamburoni took that job, if you told me, what is it, 8 years later, 7 years later, that they would not have won a playoff game, I would have lost all the money in the bank.
At number 12, the Loyola Greyhounds. I picked them with 11 wins. You picked them at 9.5. They came in at 12. I guess my question is, it's pretty clear that Loyola is better than we expected. Was it a surprise that they were this much better, or is that win total a function of their schedule?
After watching them, you know, I covered the Towson game on the Patriot League Network, and then I spent a lot of time at practice this year for a change. And, man, I was just so impressed with their staff from top to bottom, whether it's Coach Dwan, Coach Vakeness, MVR, Mark Van Arsdale, and Coach Toomey. So I got so much respect for them. I think the two freshmen on attack played better than we thought, you know, a little slow starting. And this is a team I kind of like next year. I kind of like them a lot next year. I think they're going to be right where they were this year, you know, quarterfinalists, maybe with a chance to make it to championship weekend.
Well, they've got the alpha male, and if this year's any indication based on what Ben Reeves and Justin Gutterding were able to do, you know, no one rises to the level of Pat Spencer, and it would be foolish to bet against them.
Yeah, the big question marks will be defensive midfield,
yep,
where they lose their two shorties, and then who's your number one cover guy down low?
Yep.
Can they get bigger and stronger and more physical with their defense? Because that seems to be surfacing now when they play ACC and Big Ten and athletic teams.
Johns Hopkins at number 11. We both had them at 9 wins, and they finished up with 11. Congratulations to the Blue Jays. Really impressive campaign.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. There are people who are bullish on them for next year. I just don't see it. You know, I think they'll at best be what they were this year. I don't think this program has the athletes to make a championship weekend or a title run.
I think, you know, the reasons for optimism center around guys like Connor DeSimone and Cole Williams, but I do think that the absence of Joel Tinney's explosiveness and what he brought from a toughness and emotion standpoint, at the very least, it's a substantial question.
Good close D and good pulse.
Yeah.
That's the strength. But again, you're only as good as your short stick midfield defense. Apparently, their incoming class has some big stud athletes, but when was the last time a freshman stepped up and was a number one cover guy as a shorty? You know, that's a position that lends itself to veterans like a Tyler Warner or a Goodrich. You know, it's hard to jump in that spot as a freshman and be a dominator.
Yeah. Well, Goodrich actually, I think, was pretty good as a freshman. Definitely better as a sophomore.
Yeah, no, good, but he was the second fiddle. Remember, yeah. He played behind Jack.
Adams.
Was it Adams?
Yep.
Yeah.
North Carolina, number 10. I picked them to have 11 wins. You picked them to have 8.5. They finished with 7. Syracuse, we can talk about them in conjunction. We both picked them at 9 wins, and they finished with 8.
What's that team going to look like next year? I mean, you got Trippy on attack maybe with Matthews, and I don't know, you know. I really don't know what that team's going to look like. The defense, they're apparently going to have a little, maybe a coaching change. It's again, they look like bottom tier in the ACC.
Yeah, but I don't know. I'm always going to struggle to sell on them because of the legacy of 2016, and it's a function of the fact that they weren't that good throughout the year, and then got good late, and it's the reversion of the fact that prior to that, I'd always adopted the opposite stance, which was
who are their great players? You know, I like the
but who were their great players at the end of 2015? Did we know Stephen Pontrello was going to become what he became?
He's a pro. Stephen Kelly's facing off on Saturday night when I cover the BayHawks. Austin Pafani's a pro. They were just underachievers, but they had pros dotting that lineup.
Yeah, I mean, Timmy Kelly could be a pro. I think he has that level of athleticism.
I don't think he's got even remotely the speed necessary to be a pro.
Syracuse?
Again, why would they have a better year next year that, you know, because they bring the same average players back? I don't know.
Did they have a good year? I mean, they under hit our projected win total by 1. They played what I think was their best game of the season in their season-ending loss, but they ran up against a Cornell team that played its best game of the season, or at least its best last 10 minutes of the season. Syracuse also made some really bad mistakes down the stretch of that game to give away the win.
I sense a frustration between their potential in the eyes of their staff and the reality sometimes. You know, again, they should be better because Dordovic and Curry will be better.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, I Trimboli, I thought, disappeared the last 5 games of the season.
Yep.
I have to check the stats. I love Mellon. You know, Fusco didn't do much for me. I didn't think the goaltending got better as the year went along. Fogo was still kind of not good. They ran so many midfielders who really found rhythm and a flow, and it just, I don't know. I didn't have confidence in that team in late April and May.
And number 8, Ohio State. I projected 11 wins. You projected 8.5. They finished with 8 at the other end.
Yeah, baby. That was one. You know, I was texting you all season. You're like, why is everyone so bullish on Ohio State? Why is everyone so bullish on Ohio State? They actually turned it around and finished up the season for a team that's lost 5 in a row. At the end of the year, you could argue that they should have been in the NCAA tournament. So I give Coach Myers, his staff, the players on the team, they went through a lot. If you watched the season, you saw it, you could feel for it, you could taste it, right? And I give them a ton of credit because they weren't that good. They had a lot of new faces. But I think going forward, they're in the mix.
Yeah, so the Rutgers Scarlet Knights, I had them at 10, you had them at 11.5, they come in at 9. For me, you know, this was kind of the year. It was the end of a 3-year crest. I think that they're going to be a lot different next year. They had a ton of great seniors. Jules Henningberg was so good. And a couple of the balls just didn't bounce their way.
Was our prediction prior to the Shirley Lambides injury, or was it after?
I believe it was prior to.
Yeah, so that would have, I would have taken down by 1 or 2 games. So that's kind of right in line with expectations. You know, good team, played inconsistent kind of in the big picture, and lost games.
Notre Dame, number 6. I had them at 9. You had them at 8.5. Right on the button at 9. They are who we thought
nice
they
job.
Were.
They are who they thought they were, you know, until they figure out their half-field offense. I'm not sure they're capable of winning a national championship. I do think that most this year, Costabile or Gleason were in the lineup. The motion offense looked better than it has, but the lack of goaltending was costly this season.
And number five, the Denver Pioneers. I had them at 11 wins. You had them 13.5. Their total middled at 12. Really, like, they were kind of just that Georgetown went away from ending up right where you predicted them.
Yeah. And you think about, you know, the opportunity that they failed to capitalize on when they had that big lead early March when they're in Durham. That's going to be an interesting program going forward. You know, they just need some Dodgers in the offense. They need some guys who can draw double teams because they're obviously skillful and they shoot so well. And life after Trevor Bautista is going to be fascinating as well.
No question. And then the top four, we've already talked about them at length, so we'll just run through the totals. Maryland, I had them at 12. You had them at 12.5. They finished with 12 wins. Yale, I had them at 13. You had them at 12.5. They finished with 13 wins. So pat ourselves on the back there. Albany, I had them at 13. You had them at 12.5. They finished with 14 wins. So the Great Danes put together an even better season than the very high expectations we had for them. Duke, I had them 11. You had them at 12. They finished with 13 wins. That despite losing the ACC semifinals. They were looking at a 15-win regular season, which I think, you know, that would have been pretty exceptional. But not a ton of deviation or deviance from what you would have expected.
Interesting how we're good at the top teams. And again, when I tweeted that out in September from Pullman, Washington, who I liked, you know, Duke was there. I had Duke, Denver, Albany, and Yale were my top four. So I had Maryland 5 and Rutgers 6. So, and just about everybody was on that. Now going forward, what I'll do is I take Ed Lee's work and I take Patrick Stevens' work. And if Lackenhorn wants to get all with his early projections, I'll sit on those for the summer and then combine it with what I see at Under Armour. We got games on June 30th, ESPNU, the boys and girls teams, on that Saturday, June 30th, from Baltimore, from Homewood Field. So covering that will help. And then the transfer wire. You know, I'm not in a rush. So I know Stevie likes and Patrick likes doing it fast. I don't think it pays to do this fast. I think you gotta let all the pieces fall in line.
Get your face-off yearbook orders in now. It's going to be a great 2019. Quint, we'll come back with one more podcast before the 2018 college lacrosse season is put in the books. If anybody has a particular moment, memory, player, or team you'd like us to discuss, hit us up on Twitter. I am at Terrence Foy. He is at Q Kesnick. You can find us at Inside Lacrosse. If you liked what you heard, which we apologize for the audio issues in the back half of this show, you'll, I suppose, only have to deal with it, then head to iTunes and leave a rating and a review. We certainly appreciate that fifth star. And like I said, support our partners, Trimino, Sideline Swap, and ZipRecruiter.
Yeah, I just want to thank the fans who listened. Many of them paid for place. It was cool thinking about the stadium this year. I'm not sure that Boston should be in the future as a site for championship weekend. But about the fans, and I love you guys, and you know, feeling the energy walking to and from work each day with an Asian park and putting the pictures. I mean, it was just a great reminder how much the fans that were out there and how much they love the content. And I do want to send a congratulations to Terry for your main cover, which proved who you are. To have Ben Reeves, the Boston College, you know, the two Wartime winners, I believe, on the cover is, you know, doesn't happen. When you have to predict things 2 months in advance, it rarely works out well.
Well, thank you for saying so, and thank you for listening. We will be back in the coming days. I don't know if it'll be next week, but it'll be sometime in the not-too-distant future.
Hashtag embrace the grind. We work for the fans. We work for the 71 Division I teams. Hashtag don't quit.